I'm Jack Davis. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
It's good to be here and good to be sober. My home group is the Bay Meadows Group in Jacksonville, Florida, and I bring you greetings and the weather from Florida. I want to thank the committee for inviting me up to share with you and give me the opportunity to share what you have shared with me and tell you how it's changed my life. We had a great time on the golf course this morning. It did not disrupt my serenity. And that in itself is a miracle. I have a home group, as I told you. I am a sponsor. I have a sponsor. I've worked the steps of this program and continue to work the steps of this program to the best of my ability. And as a result of these and other actions that you have suggested to me, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. And for that, I'm grateful. My sobriety date is June 5th, 1987. I didn't get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous on time, but I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was ready. I don't talk a lot about my drunkalog because I have heard drunkalogs in these rooms that curl what little hair I have left. And I tend to talk more about my recovery because that's where I am today and that's what I think is important. To give you a capsule summary, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Silver Spring, Maryland in February of 1972. And I was immediately taken by the spirituality of this program and this way of living. And I could easily see how it would be adapted to my life. So I went immediately to my second meeting in June of 1985 in Castleberry, Florida. And that was not 90 meetings in 90 days. And I did not stay sober. So my journey here was long and at times painful and at times pretty funny. I grew up in central Pennsylvania and went to Penn State. And I only mention that because at this time of year in North Florida, an agnostic is defined as someone who does not believe in Steve Spurrier. So I am glad to be out in North Florida right now. My dad was a drunk, and I grew up in what I was later to learn was a dysfunctional family. I didn't know that when I was growing up, and I didn't learn that until I had a lot of money, and I chose to spend some of that money on a psychiatrist, avoiding the inevitable, which was the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent thousands of dollars and many years sitting in a shrink's office, smiling and lying to him. And he sat there and smiled back at me and took my check and said, if I had your problems, I'd drink too. And, you know, during all that process, he encouraged me to get in touch with my inner child. And I could never raise that sucker. And about 2 weeks when I was 2 weeks sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I finally talked to my inner child, and my inner child said, I'll have a double scotch straight up with a beer chaser. So, the only difference between AA and my psychiatrist is $149 an hour. So, but when I was growing up, I now know, looking back, I could see the symptoms. I was an alcoholic in an embryonic stage, and all it took was some years later to add the alcohol. I saw things in my family, and I saw the games in my family, and I was a participant of those games, and I was a product of that alcoholic environment. I refer to my family as an emotional SWAT team. If you didn't come to breakfast with three resentments, you were outgunned at the table. And it's still that way. But you know, it doesn't bother me anymore. And I don't have to partake in that sickness. And you taught me how not to do that. And for that, I'm very grateful. I went off to school. I became an overachiever because I was always trying to get the attention of a dad who wasn't there. And during that process, I excelled academically, I excelled in sports, I excelled in extracurricular activities, and I got a scholarship to Penn State. Now, I didn't drink until I was 17 years old. I had my first drink when I was 17 years old, and it was beer. And all I can remember about that is it made me feel different. and it made me feel part of. And I liked it. And it became my solution. And what I really remember about my childhood was when I was about 8, 9 years old, sitting at the top of the steps, waiting for my dad to come home drunk, to drag him up the stairs and put him to bed, and saying to myself, I will never, ever be like that. And you can imagine the guilt and the shame and the remorse that I felt when I came home and my daughter was waiting at the window to put her dad to bed. So when I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I carried a lot of baggage with me. My dad, by the way, got sober and died 10 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I'm very grateful. I was not sober at that time, and we didn't have the kind of relationship that we might have had. But I'm grateful for the relationship we did have. And I see him in an entirely different light today. And I know that he was doing, just like the rest of us, the best we can with what we have. I went off to State College, and there's a little drinking at Penn State. I know you find that hard to believe. And I got caught up in that because I desperately wanted to be part of, and I felt different. I always felt just a little bit different. And when I drank, I didn't feel different. I was taller and thinner and prettier, and I had hair. All those things that I wanted, that I thought were real important, I could have when I was drinking. And I became a blackout drinker 2 years after I started drinking. I had my first blackout when I was a sophomore at Penn State. And I only recall two things about that. One, I knew it was different. And two, I didn't want to tell anybody about it. And I didn't. And you told me about the progressive nature of this disease, and I can look back now and see how the disease worked in my life, and I can literally see and track the progression of my disease. And I did not have that information at that time, and I probably wouldn't have acted on it if I had it. But at that time, it was my solution. Whenever I was out of sorts, whenever things weren't going my way, I could change who I was by simply picking up a drink. I finished up at Penn State, and I had run out my college deferment, and at that time they still had the draft, and I didn't really know what to do with my life. I was kind of running around rudderless, and my uncle suggested that I not join the Army because he had been in the Army, and that didn't work for him. They sent him to Korea. So I enlisted in the Air Force. And I will remember this day as long as I live. I went into the recruiter's office, and he said, "Son, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "Well, I was an English major at Penn State and a political science minor, and I'm kind of thinking about being an attorney." And he pulled out this huge computer printout, and he leafed through every page of this thing, page after page after page after page. And he looked up, and he said, "We don't need any attorneys today. We need spies." So they made me a spy. Now that is a great job for an active alcoholic. I didn't want to tell anybody, and now I couldn't. But the spy business isn't all it's cracked up to be. I kind of related to my early recovery. It was long periods of inactivity punctuated with brief moments of high drama. In my early recovery, I equate that to the times that my sponsor would call me. Whenever my sponsor would ring me and say, "I haven't heard from you for a while, and I need to remind you that nothing good happens when I call you." So I spent my tour in the Air Force and spent a 15-month tour over in Pakistan, which was an unusual experience for an active alcoholic. I used that time to try and destroy my mind. I drank a lot of scotch and I drank a lot of beer, and my disease progressed. And the blackouts got worse, and I never told anyone. And it continued. And I got out of the service, and I ended up at the National Security Agency in Washington, D.C. Now, here I am walking around with all the nation's secrets. and a pretty bad habit. But, you know, you would think with the level of security clearance that it takes to work at the National Security Agency that you would see the most straight, middle-of-the-road people in the world, and there was the biggest bunch of kooks that I ever ran into in my life. But I know that'll make you all sleep better tonight. One of us has their finger on the button. But I started a progression of moves, and I'm not sure to this day whether it's because I'm 100% alcoholic or 50% Irish, but every time I moved and changed to avoid confronting my disease, I fell up. I would take a job. I got married in 1968. I had met a woman and known her for 2 years, and I hid my drinking so well that she did not know that I had a problem with alcohol. And I developed this pattern of hiding my drinking. And the worse my drinking got, the more I worked at hiding it. We did have a situation come up in 1972, which took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got home one night drunk, and I was a bar drinker, and I was a periodic drinker. I did not drink every day. But I got home from work, and I had been drinking, and she said, "I think you drink too much." And I looked her right in the eye, and I said, "I don't think you drink enough." And I would not do anything about it, but she said, "Will you come to family counseling with me?" And I said yes, because I had had it. My daughter was born in 1971. And it's interesting, these coincidences that we discover as we look back. The minister in our church in Silver Spring, Maryland, was a classmate of my dad's in college and was from our hometown and knew my dad and knew his condition. And that man was perceptive enough to sense that I had a problem with alcohol and to not confront me with that problem. He just suggested that I might get some valuable information from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he gave me a where and when and suggested that I go to a meeting, which I did. I was in a good mood, and I didn't think you could hurt me. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was in a church in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I remember it to this day. I was greeted. I came into the room. There were probably 30 people in the room. Everyone was drinking coffee, and at that time, everyone was smoking cigarettes. And you all looked like you had been sober since the earth cooled. And I was scared to death. I was absolutely petrified because I saw what I wanted in the eyes of the people in that room, and I didn't know how to ask for it. I did not know how to tell you, "My name is Jack, and I'm an alcoholic." I did not know how to tell you, "I need your help." And I am absolutely certain that until there is a problem, there cannot be a solution. So I left that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, "This is a wonderful program, and I wish you all well." And I had no intention of ever returning to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But then the progression of the disease took over and kind of altered my plans for me. As I mentioned, as I sensed in work situations that people might have an idea that I had a problem with alcohol and may not be playing with a full deck, I would set up the circumstances to create a move. And every time I moved, I got promoted. I went through a series of job changes. My daughter, by the time she was 10 years old, had lived in 5 houses in 4 states. And every time I moved, I got more money, a more prestigious position, and I discovered the concept of stuff. And stuff became my weapon. Stuff became my security blanket. And I would say to you, don't look at me, look at my stuff. Don't look at me, look at my car. Don't look at me, look at my house. Don't look at me, look at my country club. Don't look at me, look at my daughter in private school. How could a guy with all this stuff, not have his act together. And I hid behind that stuff just as long as I could. I ended up in Orlando, Florida in 1980. And at the time, I was vice president of advertising for a bank in Boston. And I had a friend in Orlando that whom I had met in a professional association. And he got a call from a data processing company in Altamont Springs. And they said that they needed a vice president of marketing who knew something about banking and something about data processing. Gave him my name. They happened to call me in January, which is a good time. If you're recruiting for Florida, it's a good time to recruit in Boston. And I flew down to Altamont Springs, met with this guy, and came home. And we had just moved into a new house within the last 6 months. My daughter was in a new school, beautiful home, the house my wife had always wanted. And I said, we are moving to Florida. I leave next week. Sell a house and come along. That's how much respect and that's how much concern and that's how much compassion I had for my family when I was using alcohol. And I moved down to Altamont Springs, and the progression of the disease continued, and I sensed again that it was time for a move. And I don't know why to this day. It was an act of sheer stupidity, I'm certain. But I decided to start my own business in Orlando, Florida. So in 1982, I opened my own business, hung my name on the door, and said, this is where I'm going to stay. Well, in 1982, I also had my first DUI. And I handled that situation the way I handled every situation in my life. I threw money at it. I called my attorney. My attorney referred me to another attorney. I wrote that attorney a check for $3,500. The DUI was reduced to reckless. I had no problem. In 1983, I got my second DUI. Same drill. Called my attorney. Wrote him a check for $4,500 this time. DUI got reduced for reckless. I didn't lose my license. No problem. 1984, my now annual DUI. My attorney called me the first 5 years I was sober. He said, are you still sober? I need the business. I did refer some people to him. The insanity of this disease. And I sought again psychiatric help, because I knew now that I had a problem. I just didn't want your solution. And you know, when you send an active alcoholic to a psychiatrist, it's like sending a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. There is absolutely nothing there to work with. And I ran that string out. And finally, I don't know why, to this day, I do not know why, but I decided in July of 1985 to come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, to do that, I carefully selected a meeting location that was off my normal path, because I didn't want anyone to see me make this attempt to save my life. I didn't care that I was on videotape in the Orange County Sheriff's Office, that I had been seen falling off bar stools in most of the bars in Central Florida. Didn't bother me a lick. But when I decided that I might want to do something about saving my life, I didn't want anyone to know. And I went to the Rebos Club in Castleberry, Florida. And I sat down and I said, my name is Jack and I am an alcoholic. And I didn't believe it. And you people made me feel welcome. Same look that I saw in 1972 in Silver Spring, Maryland, was there. And I recognize that look today, and that look is hope. And what you are saying to me with your eyes is recovery is possible. And I didn't know that at that time. And I picked up a white chip. They have a chip system down in Central Florida. And I picked up a white chip, and I picked up a red chip, which was 90 days sober. And I picked up a blue chip, which was 6 months of sobriety. And I went to a 5:30 meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for 8 months. And I got drunk. And what I learned from that experience is I can't stay sober on your AA. I cannot stay sober on the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is essential to my recovery. I can't live without you people. You give me strength when I have none. You hold me when I can't hold myself. You give me hope. You give me encouragement. You give me your love. And you give me your support. But I could not stay sober on your AA. And I came back and I picked up a white chip. And I picked up a red chip. And I picked up a blue chip. And I stayed sober for 9 months. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for 9 months. And I got drunk. And what I learned from that experience is that there's a lot more for me to Alcoholics Anonymous than not drinking and going to meetings. If you believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is simply not drinking and going to meetings, let me suggest this. That you take one of these chairs and put it out in that parking lot and sit in it for an hour a night, a couple times a week. And I'll come back up here next year and you tell me if you're a Chevrolet. I cannot stay sober by simply not drinking and going to meetings. And when I came back the third time, there was a guy in this club, and there's a guy like this in every club. This guy's name was Johnny Sarge. He was about 18 years sober at the time. He was a retired Air Force Master Sergeant. He was my height. He probably weighed 110 pounds soaking wet. He was jaundiced from this disease, and he used to sit in the corner of the club room. And it always looked like he was half asleep. And Johnny was one of those guys who spoke in the slogans. I would get to a meeting early or be afraid and not want to go after the meeting, and I would stay there and I would talk to him and I would pour out my heart to John. And John would just at the appropriate time just kind of jerk his head up a little bit and look at me and say, "Let go and let God." And I'd talk to him again another day and I would go into detail about all these issues that I was confronting and how hard I was trying to stay sober and what I was doing and how frustrating it was. And he'd lift up his head at the appropriate time and look at me and say, "Easy does it." And you don't know how that infuriated me. How could that man be so cold and insensitive? How could he do that? Did he not know that I was an extremely sensitive person with complex issues in my life? I really don't to this day know why I kept going back to him. But Johnny saw me come and Johnny saw me go. And when I came back the third time, he called me over and he said, "Jack, do you want to get sober?" And I said, "John, I hope dearly to get sober." And he said, "Well, what do you think the problem is, Jack?" And I said, "John, every time I do a fourth step, I start to work on a fourth step, I get full of guilt and remorse and self-loathing about all the chaos that I created when I was ripping and running." And John said, "Well, it's my experience, Jack, that if you think you're having a problem with a step in this program, that step is not the problem. It's the step before." And he said, "Do you know what grace is?" And I said, "Of course I do. That's what all newcomers say when you ask them a question." And John, having been around a while, decided to tell me anyhow. And what John would share in meetings, he would introduce himself by saying, "I am a grace-arrested alcoholic. My name is Johnny Sarge." And Johnny told me that his grace was the unconditional, unmerited love of a higher power, and that all his higher power asked of him was that he do the best he could with what he had today. And Johnny gave me his higher power. And I believe today that that is one of the reasons I am sober and standing before you today. And I am glad and I thank God every day that Johnny lived long enough and I stayed long enough that we could both have the same higher power. And I started through the steps of the program with a sponsor. And I believe that sponsorship is essential. It is one of the essential aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am concerned about lack of sponsorship. Because I have heard people talk about things that are dividing AA and situations and circumstances that are occurring in AA. And I don't think that we have any problem in Alcoholics Anonymous today that cannot be explained by a sponsor using the steps and using the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that sincerely. And I selected a sponsor who I knew could take me through the steps, and then I had a vital element. I had someone who could share his experience with me and guide me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to teach me how to deal with life on life's terms. And I had no problem dealing with or admitting the that I was powerless over alcohol. But I had a real problem with the second part of that first step. I had a rough time accepting the unmanageability of my life. And someone said to me, the best definition of unmanageability for an alcoholic is we break our own rules. Alcoholics break their own rules. And sometimes they're little rules and sometimes they're big rules. I'll get the report in on Monday. I'll be home for dinner. I will only have one drink. I broke all those rules. I will not drive drunk. I will not hit you. And I broke those rules. And that is unmanageability. And I had absolutely no problem believing that I was insane. I had no problem with the insanity of this disease when I looked back and saw what alcohol had done. And there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that I was a real alcoholic. Because when I put one ounce of alcohol in this body, I can no longer predict what this body will do. And that makes me a real alcoholic. And what you told me was, if you don't drink, you can't get drunk. Made sense to me. And I had a new attitude and awareness. And in the third step, you know, everybody agonizes over the third step of this program, and it is not really, in retrospect, that big a deal. We have a choice. We can either accept a spiritual way of life, or we can die an alcoholic death. That is not a trick question. I have a choice, a very clear choice. I can either accept a spiritual way of life or die an alcoholic death. And unfortunately, I have seen people make the wrong choice. In the first 6 months of this year, I had four friends of mine die in this program, trying to convince people, and mostly themselves, that they could drink like normal people. I have yet to ever hear somebody go out and fortunately make it back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I just stopped by to tell you it's really better out there. I have yet to hear that message. And yet we do it. And it's that feeling of difference that must be destroyed. I had a friend who got sober under a bridge in Jacksonville, and he was in Orlando when I was getting sober, and he would not speak to me the first 6 months I was sober. Because he came to Alcoholics Anonymous from under a bridge, And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous driving a new Corvette. And I didn't realize that we were not different. The book says it eloquently. The tremendous thing about every one of us is that we have found a common solution. And that guy listened to me and sat next to me in meetings for 6 months and never said a word to me. And he came up to me one day after a meeting and said, "Do you know how to strain sterno?" And I just looked at him and I said, "Heavens, no." Never entered my mind. And he said to me, "Jack, unless you realize that you're a garden variety drunk just like the rest of us, you will end up under that bridge." And that's the kind of love that I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was the message that I needed to hear. I didn't need somebody patting me on the back and telling me to keep coming back. I needed somebody to shake me by the heart and by the gut and get me to look at the seriousness of my condition. I realize now that the third step of this program simply says to me, "Jack, you are responsible for the effort and not the result." Trying to manipulate and manage and control the situations and circumstances of my life are what brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you would have just done what I thought was best when I thought it was okay, I probably wouldn't have had to drink. It was just sheer frustration at your lack of perception that took me to the bottom. So realizing, and another important aspect of that, and my sponsor made it very clear to me, he said, "Jack, there is a promise that we will realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And there is a corollary to that promise, that God expects us to do for ourselves what we can do for ourselves. And if you expect God to move a mountain, bring a shovel." And that's the marching instructions I got. And I did a four-step the way it's written in the big book. No complex formulas, no manuals, no seminars, no workshops. Sat down, ledger sheet, like Jay was talking about, wrote them down, and owned my part of it. And the amazing thing that happened, I had the exact same feeling that Jay talked about last night. The anger and the rage started to leave. And I believe that that is when I started to accept the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life. Because until that time, the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous had been extended to me, but I was holding on to all the garbage that I brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I refused to let go. And until I let go, I could not take the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that that happened to me during the fourth and fifth step. And I'll share a little observation with you about, again, the importance of sponsorship. I had finished my fifth step with my sponsor, and we had decided to take a walk. We were out in a secluded area outside of Orlando, and we were walking down this path. And I was in the lead. Of course, that's where I was supposed to be. And he was walking behind. And the path got narrower and narrower, and we came to an outcropping of rock. And sitting up on the rock, I looked up, and there was a Florida panther. And I didn't know what to do. I turned around, and my sponsor had sat down. And he was taking off his hiking boots and putting on a pair of Reeboks. Now I had two dilemmas. I did not know what was going on in front of me, and I did not know what was going on behind me. And I turned around to my sponsor, and I looked at him. I said, "You're not going to outrun that panther." He said, "I don't have to outrun the panther. I just have to outrun you." And that is why sponsorship is essential. They teach us how to deal with life situations. I went on to the sixth and seventh step of this program, and I characterized the sixth and seventh step of this program as the shooting gallery step. Coming out of the fourth and fifth step, I now had a list of character defects, of shortcomings. I had gotten rid of all that garbage that would immediately take me to a bottle. I had realized I was powerless over alcohol. But the only thing that happened when I stopped drinking was I stopped drinking. When I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a liar and a whiner and a quitter. And those were my survival skills. And what I know today is that if you don't change your survival skills in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will go back to the environment where you can use them. And in the sixth and seventh step, I now knew what my shortcomings were. I believe that God removed those defects of character that stood between my relationship with Him. But I also believe that I have an awareness of those that persist today. And I suffer from a disease that is characterized by acute self-deception. When it works, it's my idea. When it doesn't work, it's your fault. I believe that I have to be careful. And if you remember, some of the older folks, I'm sure, will remember the carnival sideshows with the shooting galleries, with those little ducks that would come up, and you'd shoot the duck and it would go down. Come on. Well, now, because of the sixth and seventh step, those ducks have names. There's selfishness, and there's self-centeredness, and there's ego, and there's pride, and there's fear. And all those ducks have a name. And some days, that duck will pop up and I'll shoot it and it'll go down and stay down. And other days, that duck just keeps popping back up. Every time I shoot it, it pops back up. But at least I have a name, and at least I can put a name on it, and at least I know what it is. And as a result of that activity, I have one of the most precious gifts of recovery. And I call it the gift of the second thought. I don't react today any differently to life when I was drinking. But what I have through your guidance and your example and your strength is an option. I have the ability to intercept the thought before I take the action. I can say to myself when I'm confronted with a situation, wait a minute, Jack, if you do what you're thinking about doing, it's not going to work out very well. And I have the option of changing my action. The gift of the second thought. And that is a precious gift to me. It calls for fewer and fewer amends. Now, just because I have this knowledge doesn't always mean that I put it into action. But at least today I have the awareness and I know why. I know why the situations are created. And you know, we talk about the 10th and the 11th and the 12th steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as the maintenance steps. And I really think they're the growth steps. I did my 8th and 9th step. And I did that rather promptly. I had accumulated a substantial amount of debt living the lifestyle that I lived before I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've retired most of that debt. I talked to the people who I had identified in my 4th step. And my sponsor, again, gave me a valuable piece of information during that process, too. The toughest 9th step I had to make was with my daughter. And my sponsor said to me before I went to talk to her, Jack, replace the you with I. And instead of telling her what she should do and what she shouldn't do, tell her what you can do and what you can't do. And as a result of that conversation, our relationship has changed. My daughter, unfortunately, is out there qualifying for membership in this organization. She has not yet added to her resume in sufficient depth to come to these rooms. But our relationship has changed. Because what she sees now is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous who does not yell at her, who does not blame her, who does not point the finger, who does not ignore her, who tells her he loves her and gives her the opportunity to make her choices. And regardless of the choices she makes, still loves her. And I believe that if it's God's will, she will find her way to these rooms. And I also believe that she may not. But I realize that that is not my job. And for that, I'm grateful. I have practiced prayer and meditation in this program since I got started in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is a great source of comfort to me. I take an inventory at the end of the day, and I have the opportunity to fix little problems while they're still little problems. I never had the ability to say, wait a minute, this is going the wrong way. I would always let it turn into a catastrophe. I was a crisis junkie. I'm not a crisis junkie anymore. And I spent a lot of time on the 11th step of this program because I believe that faith is not so much belief in things unseen as it is trust without reservation. And I work on trust all the time. And I know the two biggest roadblocks that I have in my life are my pride and my ego. And they stand sentinel at the door of my heart. And they shut God out. And with that knowledge, I can work on that and open my heart to God. And when I do, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things happen. My life is no more today what I thought it would be than anything. I cannot tell you how much I have gained and benefited as a result of my experience in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has not been roses. When I was a year sober, I lost that family. When I was 2 years sober, I lost my business. When I was 3 years sober, I lost my house. And I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And somebody in the room said to me, Jack, sometimes you have to lose everything you have to find out what's worth keeping. And I realize today that if I had not lost all that stuff would stand between me and God. And I am grateful. 7 years ago, I met a lady in recovery. And 4 years ago, 3 years ago, we got married. I have a wonderful, sharing, trusting relationship with a woman I love and a woman who loves me. She was going to try and be here today. She went back to school. She's going to graduate from nursing school in December. And she's on break, and she had a family situation that came up, and she was really looking forward to being here with you. And when I tell her what a wonderful time I had in Cartersville, and she will be sorry that she didn't make it, but it was an unavoidable situation. She knows that the further I get from my home group, the better my story gets. So to protect you all, she sent her brother. My brother-in-law, Bill, is here. Bill carries the message in Cleveland, Ohio. And he flew into Atlanta. I picked him up yesterday morning, and he came here to help you keep me honest. Actually, Bill's kind of competitive, and he heard that they were playing golf down here this morning. And that was enough motivation for him to come. But he also heard that there was the Any Lengths prize for the person who came the greatest distance to attend the roundup. And Bill wants to know who he sees to get his name in the drawing. Another great joy of my life, a brother that I never had. And we see each other a couple times a year, and we have a common bond. And there's no competition, and there's no bull. It's just one drunk talking to another drunk. And it's absolutely wonderful. I got my business started a couple years ago in Jacksonville, and it's doing really well. I really didn't know what was going to happen. But I will tell you this. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. I just really enjoy suiting up and showing up. And what a great relief it is to know that I'm not in control of this show anymore. What a wonderful life and a wonderful experience you have given me. And I am truly grateful for that. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous has a very clear and a very unambiguous message. And that message is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that message is sponsorship. And that message is service. Those of you who are involved in service take more away from this program. And there's a tremendous willingness to do service work in Alcoholics Anonymous. About 10% of the people are willing to do it, and the other 90 are willing to let us. But the people who have what I want are all involved in service work. They're all involved in service work. And I found out the secret of successful recovery. It is not difficult. Find someone who has what you want and do what they do. And you will get what they get. I have a big book that my sponsor gave me when I started on this journey. And he handed me a big book and he opened it up and he ripped out the first 164 pages. He said, "You don't need the entertainment section yet." And so I carry that big book with me. I have it in my room. And I put it in a little leather cover to keep it from falling apart. And every once in a while, people give me things or I hear things and I jot them down and I stick them in the jacket of that book. And when I came in last night and saw the theme of your conference, it reminded me of something that somebody gave me in AA a long time ago. And I brought it with me and I'd like to close with it. It's called AA Love. "This love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. It looks for a way of being constructive. It is not possessive. It is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. This love has good manners and does not pursue selfish advantage. It is not touchy. It does not compile statistics of defects or gloat over the mistakes of other people. On the contrary, it is glad with all good people when truth prevails. This love knows no limit to its endurance, no end to its trust, no fading of its hope. It can outlast anything. It is, in fact, the one thing that still stands when all else has fallen. This is my love for you, the love that all AAs have for each other." Thank you very much.